This is Sam Edwards, proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network, SurreyFarms.com.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. That was just Wet Hair by Japan Droids, one of my favorite albums to listen to get ready for summer. And summer is here, or briefly teasing us with what is an 85 plus degree Monday, which is great.
Love it.
Love it. Tough way to get into the office, but a beautiful way to start the week. I'm joined once again by the illustrious hair-holding champion of Brooklyn, Travis Hayden. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes.
It's good to be back. 2 weeks in a row.
Thank you for the phone call up in Montreal.
Of course.
I missed you too, buddy. I was busy eating my face off at Joe Beef in the Cabane de Sucre, which I just butchered, of Apia Gachon, and I'm hurting. It's a hurt. It's a hurt. How was your weekend?
It was great. Sunny. Did nothing. No work, which was nice. Laid out, read some books, relaxed, home repairs.
I was going to say you look a little tan.
Yeah, working on it.
Working on it.
Yeah,
working
thanks, on New York.
Well, we are very excited about today. Two heavy hitters from the food and music and media industry are joining us in studio. First off, we have Mitchell Davis, who is from the James Beard Foundation and Above and Beyond. Mitchell, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And we have the man who I used to watch in my parents' basement on TV, on MTV, John Norris. Welcome to Snacky Tunes as well.
How are you, sir?
Good, good. I realize that that statement sounded a little bit...
Oh, yeah. No, it just makes me feel old, but it's cool.
It's cool. We grew up together. You just didn't know okay. who I was.
I was growing up then, too.
Yes. So we have Mitchell on, who is no stranger to Heritage Radio Network with his own show, airing every Tuesdays.
Wednesdays. At 11.
At 11 a.m.
Yeah.
That's an early time to get on the radio.
Yeah, it's quiet around here as Roberta's wakes up, and so does everyone listening at home.
Yes, it's good. But Mitchell, beyond that, you are a cookbook author, food journalist, scholar with a doctorate in food studies.
Sorry, I just fell asleep.
No, but I mean, you know, you're well-rounded. For those who don't know you beyond just that you're the vice president of the James Beard Foundation.
And yeah, well, food is one of those things. It's like music. It's kind of all-consuming. You know, yes. You do it when you go to work, and you do it when you come home, so...
It's great that, you know, I think you've found food and applied it to every outreach of your life as possible.
I'm just looking for tax write-offs mostly every time I go to the grocery store or go to a restaurant.
I think the best thing about, and today being tax day, being
right, of course. Well, actually, it's tomorrow, technically. There's some holiday today.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there was a double extension.
It's a bank holiday. Yeah. So
I was just in D.C. this morning to file them. No, that was just a joke.
But you know, the fact that you can write off every meal, every grocery shopping thing like that, it's like, this is research.
The problem the is hot pockets I have more research. Receipts than I have income. I don't know if you have this problem, but it doesn't really always work.
Yeah. Yes, I...
Add up.
Yes. And you're like, no, look, the food trip was definitely part of the job. But for all of those who don't know what the James Beard Foundation is, what is the elevator pitch of what is probably one of the most important organizations in the food world?
Well, it's funny because if you had asked me a couple of years ago, I've been there 19 years now, but a couple of years ago we were quite different, and we've branched out in many different ways. So the foundation, our mission is technically to celebrate, nurture, and preserve America's diverse culinary heritage and future. Mm-hmm. And I have to memorize that, yes, and I say it regularly. But we do some of the things that people know us for. We are based in James Beard's house in Greenwich Village, and we invite chefs from all over the world, some 230 or so nights a year. There's a different chef cooking there for some amazing bacchanal, probably not unlike you experienced in Montreal this week, but it happens every night on West 12th Street, just about every night. And we give out a large chunk of money to young aspiring culinarians for cooking schools or grants for travel and sort of food education. And in fact, actually, this year's grants are closing soon, so I'm going to make a pitch to go to jamesbeard.org if you are interested in going to culinary school or need some help to study food. At jamesbeard.org, there are all the sorts of things. We've given out almost $4 million since we started in 1991.
And does that come from things like dinner sales, ticket sales?
Yeah, we raise money for it. Some of them are tuition waivers we negotiate with schools and stuff like that. But basically, chefs around the country and around the world help us raise money to do that. And then we do the Beard Awards, which you talked about, which are coming up on May 7th for the big sort of red carpet gala at Lincoln Center. And there's a whole weekend of festivities, really. The James Beard Book Broadcast and Journalism Awards are the Friday before on May 4th. And now, in fact, I was in D.C. this morning because we're doing a lot more work now that chefs and food have become such an important part of the larger cultural conversation, policy and food system stuff and food safety. A few years ago, we launched a national food conference that's really a year-long dialogue around the country with chefs and policymakers and urban developers and people sort of looking at all the different issues that are affecting how we eat and how we decide to use the resources of the planet. So that's the new piece that's been very exciting and also sort of fits together. It's our 25th anniversary this year, and so we're really excited to be heading in all different ways.
That's amazing. I want to go back to what you just said about food and chefs becoming part of the pop culture and where James Beard has played into that, because for those who may not know, James Beard is the grandfather, the founder of all what could be considered modern cooking. He discovered Julia Child and things like that. And so James Beard, since the man lived and the inception of the foundation, has really played a part as well in shaping the dialogue of the food scene.
Yeah, well, it's hard to imagine that he died 27 years ago, actually, and the foundation was founded the year after he died. It wasn't done by him. It was done by friends of his, but in his house and in his name, really, to preserve his legacy. But Beard was the first person to cook on television in 1945, which was, the television was 9 months old when he walked onto the set. Wow. And he had his first cooking show in 1946.
What did he make his first time out?
Oh, actually, most of that's lost. Well, it's funny because we're constantly trying to find anything you can, but it was so expensive to produce TV then that they just taped over everything. There's very little stuff. There's some transcripts, and he had a food show and a commercial, and he was actually cooking something for the postman who was stopping by to deliver something. I don't know. They're really hokey. You don't
premise.
Really, yeah.
To this day, premise prevails.
Exactly. But even, you know, right up until he died in 85, people interested in food were a little wonky. You know, they just were not the mainstream in the same way. They were the snobs, or they were, you know, had traveled a little bit and I think sort of developed an interest. But it wasn't as pervasive. You didn't turn on the TV. You don't have to turn on the food television. You can turn on Bravo. You can turn on The Tonight Show. You can turn on anything. And there's a chef and there's a farmer and there's whatever going on.
So
that explosion, I think, happened since in our time. And we used to say that our mission was to shine a spotlight on the chefs and who produced the food that we enjoyed so much, but the spotlights got much bigger with 24-hour food television and all these other things. You know, there's 4 articles about the Beard Awards in People magazine in the coming weeks. That is unheard of.
In People. Wow.
Which, I mean, we love that, and we sit around the table with our publicists and think, wow, that's amazing. And they leave, and we're like, holy crap, how did that happen, you know?
No.
So it's a moment. And part of that, I mean, the reason we started to do the food conference thing was because we realized that now that chefs had this incredible media attention, maybe they could do something more than really just talk about dinner, but talk about all of these issues that other people are talking about. And it's no surprise that people like Marcus Samuelson and Dan Barber, who are great chefs and people with great vision, have been invited to speak at Davos, have been, you know, are brought back and forth to Washington, to the White House, all sorts of stuff. There's some really big stuff going on. And so we just want to help them. In fact, we're talking about creating a sort of boot camp to help them be better advocates for the issues that concern them now that they have this attention, this spotlight.
Do you feel that there's a little weight resting on your shoulders to help promote food advocacy and things like that?
Hugely. And I think the whole foundation has been the beneficiary of so much goodwill towards chefs and sort of created this model of using chefs to help raise money and raise awareness and all that stuff. And at first it was for us, which was to support them. But now that now they've gotten so big and so much support and everyone wants their attention, we're really proud to be able to help them help their own causes and advance themselves. And I mean chefs of the most fancy restaurants and the biggest names, but also the people cooking, you know, at restaurants in Brooklyn, for instance, who are just there because they love food and they're passionate about what they're doing. I mean, we really are trying to give tools and exposure to everyone who makes food for us.
Can I ask who you're excited about, who you want to see get some more exposure?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, part of this conference, I've had the good fortune of traveling around the country holding meetings in various food cities. We've been in Louisville and Portland, not just food cities, all cities are food cities, but I just got back from Charleston. And to me, what's amazing, and it's funny because I didn't know James Beard, although I feel after 19 years there that I might be James Beard. I'm not sure sometimes. It's just like we sit in amazing restaurants with amazingly passionate people talking about the things that just seemed impossible 25 years ago to be talking about in America. You know, even 20 years ago, 15 years ago, food was in France and food happened in Japan and Asia. It didn't happen here the way it's happening here now. And I mean, sitting in Roberta's here in Brooklyn kind of like an epicenter of the very thing that's happening in cities across the country. You know, I can't help but think James Beard, who really did lay a foundation for this, is just very, very happy and proud.
What is the one thing that you were surprised, even from 10 years ago, that goes beyond just, you know, more organic, local things like that?
It's really the quality of the cooking. I'm a huge... I believe there is a craft to cooking, and I don't think it's just shopping. I mean, I know there are people, you know, if you just buy a good thing and you put it on a plate, it's delicious. And I know that's true. That's what we do at home. We shop and we eat well. But I'm a real advocate of the craft of cooking. And when you go to a restaurant and you just see, right now, every chef, when I'm impressed by something, is 27 years old and they're just cooking their hearts out. And to me, that's amazing. And I'm thinking of places like in San Francisco at Commonwealth or at a place called Victory 44 in Minneapolis that... It was a bar with a chalk menu, and it literally said on it, mozzarella cheese sticks. And we expected to get mozzarella cheese sticks, and we got this incredible salad with 4 different preparations of zucchini and mozzarellas of different kinds. It was $8 in a bar in suburban Minneapolis. I mean, crazy.
Right.
That doesn't happen in France anymore. Like, in France, you have to look for food now because, you know, the the world has changed so much, and the European Union has sort of shaken things up a little bit. And the energy and the passion sort of in the hinterlands, I mean, if that, I don't mean that pejoratively, I just mean in not here in Brooklyn or New York. It's really exciting.
And do you think this is having an influence in the household as well, which is producing a younger generation that's more interested in cooking?
I think so. I'm the food guy who goes on record and doesn't hate the Food Network and the Cooking Channel, because I actually think that any media excitement gets people excited about food for that very reason.
Absolutely.
Like, it's not a popular, among the people I hang out with, it's not a popular opinion, but I really think that just anyone talking, the fact that there's this radio station and we're talking about food and people are listening to it in their iPods, you know, driving to work, I think it definitely creates an environment that only leads to better, more passionate
Absolutely,
people.
And technology as well.
Huge, actually. The social media thing actually, I think, changed cooking and chefs much more than even computers and email, because restaurants didn't have computers. We could never at the Beer Foundation in my time, you could never get a chef unless you called, because he or she would never be in front of a computer dealing with email. But now that they've got their phone in their pocket and they're tweeting and they're emailing from the line, you have much closer touch. You can tweet, if you tweet Mario Batali, he tweets you back. You know, I think sometimes he tweets all 350,000 followers he's got back, because that's what you see in your inbox. So
it's amazing, right? And especially to have that sort of access that didn't really exist before, and to take away some of that mystery of just like what really happens, you know, behind the line, behind those closed doors and things like that.
Even live feeds, like, doesn't Per Se and French Laundry have feeds?
Cameras,
or they're connected together?
Well, and the Shake Shack, the Burger Line, and, it's cool. I mean, it's, to me, there's a real similarity between chefs and music, and it's probably not a coincidence that you have a show about music and food, but...
We've been saying that for years. Well, I mean, it's the same thing now where, you know, for years, for music, you could love music, pick up guitar, fiddle around, something like that. You could make a band, make music, and that mystery was broken down maybe 60 years ago, and now with food, it's just, you know, and again, as someone who works for the Food Network and Cooking Channel time and time, I love it as well, because at the end of the day, it's like, this is what's going on in food culture. You two can get in the kitchen, make a pie. Who cares if it comes out perfect? It doesn't matter. Just like, it keeps the dialogue going. It shows people that, like, there isn't this great mystery to food if you have access to decent products and just willing to make a mistake here.
Totally. That's a really good point. To me, there's a really important ambient food culture that needs to be there, because let's face it, not everyone's going to be a foodie, nor should they be. You know, the same way that I don't really care anything about football, but I know when the Super Bowl is on, and I know that that's a piece of cultural literacy that everyone's aware of. I think good food ought to be that. The only choices ought to be good, not just to have to seek it out and that kind of thing. The same way you can turn on the TV and flip across a baseball game or whatever. So I think that's the advent of all of the stuff going on right now.
I love it. And to tie all this together, I'm playing one of my favorite songs that has a food name. It's
is that the category songs that have food names?
It's Oyster by Jawbreaker, who used to use the Morton Salt Girl as their logo, so it all ties together. But we're going to come back and we're going to focus on the amazing awards coming up in the weekend and talk about how it is the Oscars of the food world. You're listening to Snacky Tunes with Mitchell Davis, John Norris, Travis Hayden. Here we go. Oyster by Jawbreaker.
Just what I need. I can't stand your mouth. The world is an oyster, locked in a shell. You like the taste of it, can't take the smell. I dot my T's and cross my I's, pretend that I can write. I haven't got a nice thing to say.
That was just Oyster by Jawbreaker, playing off my favorite food-named songs of stuff I listened to when I was 15 years old in my room and before I thought about food. We are joined by the wonderful Mitchell Davis, who is the VP of the James Beard Foundation, among a whole biography, which is very exciting, and I think it's up online, and you should check it out because
my biography. It's not that exciting, but
it's. Yeah. I mean, it's a life in food, and it's very humbling. Let's say, but let's get to the awards happening first weekend in May.
Yep,
and it's now. I was very lucky last year to attend for the first time ever, and I was blown away.
It's fun.
It is so much fun to.
Anyone can go, by the way. I mean, it's not cheap. I think tickets are maybe $450, but you get to see, there are 40 chefs cooking incredible food. You get to see the whole show, and everyone who's anyone really is there.
And you get to walk the red carpet at Avery Fisher Hall, which is
that's fun.
If you've never gotten to walk the red carpet there, it's put on like the New York Must Die checklist or move out. So festivities start off on the 4th.
Yeah, they start off on Friday, and that's it's funny, that used to be this little dinner party for journalists, for food journalists, and we kept them separate to try to maintain the church and state thing between, you know, sponsors and journalists, and we still keep that separate, but that event has grown so big because we now do awards for electronic and media, broadcast media, and also for all the books, cookbooks and food books that come out in the year or that night. So we give out more awards on Friday night than we actually do at Lincoln Center on Monday. And that's a dinner, that's a sit-down, great event. That one is not open to the public, it's just for industry. But Monday night is the big gala, walk-around reception, black tie, red carpet, Lincoln Center, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I have my suit picked out. Your suit?
I wear a black. Yeah, I'm working, kind of, so I'm somewhere between a waiter and a vice president at that night.
Oh, you're more than that. You're more than that. So that's the 4th, and then the rest of the... There's nothing on the... Is there anything during the Friday...
Well...
The Saturday,
so Sunday? The reality is the entire world of food from the country descends on New York for those days, so you can't swing a cat in any restaurant and not hit a... Food Network star, someone, some great chef from somewhere, and then all of their fans, because everyone who's nominated, I think there might be 100 people in various categories nominated for things, so a lot of their friends and fans and family come. So it's really a great time to be in New York City, and other people plan things because they know everyone's in town, so it's
one of those things where you just get very jealous by reading chef's Twitter feed, and you see that they're all hanging out, and you're like, oh, they're at this after party and things like that. Yeah. What is your weekend like during that weekend? Because I know that you have the event, but then you have the awards on Monday, but I'm sure you're running around like crazy.
Yeah, we're running around a bit. I mean, we have a lot of things, again, because so many people are here. So we have big committee meetings. We actually have a new book out, which is called The Best of the Best. It's for our 25th anniversary. And it's recipes and profiles and beautiful photographs, all original of the top award winners. It's called the Outstanding Chef Award, and we've had 22 of them, and it's a book of them, and so we're going to throw a book party for that. We have lots of big, but we have another party with 2,000 people coming. It's a busy weekend.
Oh, right, Chef's Night Out.
Which,
I have to say, I love.
Yeah, so that's the fun one. That's the one we get. That's everyone sort of comes and grabs a beer and isn't dressed up the night before the awards and has a good time. That's a great party.
It's business casual.
Yeah. So let's depends talk, on the business.
Depends on the business. And then people get real casual. So let's talk about the... I mean, there's a ton of categories that we can't get into, but What are the big?
Well, the fun one this year. This year the new one is the Outstanding Bar Program, which is, you know, if you read the New York Times, they think that we're a little late in coming to, except that, as I said, we're a national organization, and the award is a national award, and so it can't just be a couple of underground bars in off neighborhoods of big cities. We're looking for a trend to really take hold, and we're very excited about the nominees this year. There are probably no surprises, but places like our own Jimmy and the PDT is there, and the Aviary and Violet Hour from Chicago, and Pegu Club from New York, and and it's a great list, and we're psyched to add that element to the awards. It's about time, I guess. Rising Star is always a good category because you have to be under 30. They're not always executive chefs yet. So sometimes chefs de cuisine or something like that are nominated, and it's where we see people we don't already know, or some of them we do. But this year, I'm looking at Dave Barron, from Next in Chicago, Daniel Bowen from Mission Chinese Food. Obviously, he's a huge name right now. He's coming to New York, actually, but a young guy who deserves a lot of attention, Thomas McNaughton from Flower and Water, Christina Tozzi, our Mama Fuku Milk Bar pastry goddess.
Love Tozzi.
No one doesn't love Christina Tozzi.
Yeah, I don't know anybody who's ever met Tozzi and be like, you know, I don't care for her. I don't.
Her desserts are polarizing, but the person, not at all.
Yes.
And Susan Manick from Goutreau's in New Orleans. So those are all under 30 people who, and we have a pretty good track record. Our first Rising Star nominee, winner was Todd English back in 1991, and he went on to do some things.
He's done some things. Yeah. If you've ever been to a W hotel.
And then Best New Restaurants, another great category, because of course, unlike the Academy Awards, which was actually Time Magazine called us the Oscars of the food world a long time ago, not everyone has a new restaurant every year. So sometimes in the different regional categories, the names don't change as much as you might expect, right? Like, because it's not for a new work. It's not a new movie or a new play on Broadway. Yeah. But Best New Restaurant, obviously, is something new. Funny how that happens. And the crowd, I'm just looking actually so I don't miss anybody to see what the exact who's nominated this year. But for us, that's always if you've opened a restaurant and you're a chef, that's the one you want, because that says you've done something right and everyone's noticed. And this year we've got AQ in San Francisco, Fiola in Washington, D.C., one that I'm excited to see here. And I have nothing to do with this, by the way.
I know who you're about to say.
Yes. Issa.
It should say Brooklyn, by the way.
It should say Brooklyn.
I know you want to say New York, but Issa
is... It is still part of New York. Last I checked, it's one of the five boroughs, but Issa, amazing too.
Fine. I'm just saying that you have Tertulia on there, and that can get the New York credit, and then Issa can get the Brooklyn credit, because Issa is, like, Ignacio is amazing.
Yeah, it's the balls. It's amazing.
And can I say, especially when you talk about people with new projects, to think that that was coming from the Freeman's guys... It's a total left turn.
And I'm just going to plug the Beard Foundation, because as I said, the staff has nothing to do with these awards. So you can try to butter us up with pizzas and whatever it is you want. We are not on the committees and we don't vote. We oversee them and make sure that the peers vote. But the fact that that made it to this list made me very proud of our organization, because it's a little off the beaten track. It's a little out there, and it's an amazing restaurant. After that, Next, probably the complete opposite, one of the most anticipated restaurants in the history of the universe and the most thought after restaurants. It's Grant Achatz's second restaurant, which completely changes time, food, place, plating, uniforms, everything every 3 months. So it opened in Paris. It was Paris in 1906. And then I think it was Hong Kong in 2050. And then it was his childhood. And every 3 months, it's
now
a completely
new place.
Now
it's El Bulli, I think.
Yeah, now it's El Bulli. But one particular night of El Bulli. Yeah, so that's an incredible project. And
if we can just pause right there and talk about, and as I was saying before, the pressure of eating and going to be places and things like that. Like, that is high on the list. That is not just like, oh, I went to Next once and I had the experience. It's like, I have to get there every 3 months, and I don't know if that's possible.
It's not very possible. I mean, they have the unique, they started this unique thing that I think is going to get more popular, where they sell all the seats in advance. You pay in advance, like going to a rock concert or something. And some of the seats trade for $3,000 on eBay. I mean, the reservations are not easy to come by.
But on another tangent, I think for what they're doing food-wise, they need to know that revenue is just there.
Oh, of course. Actually, it's the model the Beard Foundation uses, so I think it's a great model, but yeah.
Oh, that and by selling seats.
Well, because you have to book the reservations and pay in advance, because you have a limited number. It's a one-time thing. It's very similar, but that's a great project. The whole Next thing is kind of crazy. It's like a pop-up every 3 months. It's and the way that Grant works and his team works, they put so much energy into it. And then, as you mentioned, the last of the best new restaurant category is Tertulia, which is Seamus Mullen, a great Spanish
Love
restaurant.
It.
It's like a little piece of Spain right around the corner from the Beard House, actually.
Yes, and that wood fire anything is just fantastic.
Yeah, as the smell of smoke coming from the Roberta's oven would attest.
Yes.
So then there's a lot. Yeah, everyone should go to jamesbeard.org, and I'm not just saying that because we have a brand new website that we're very proud of that functions in a very unusual way, but because there's so much there, and we have over 100 different categories of honorees. The other one that people always look forward to and that are great are the America's Classics, and these are a little different. They're not voted on in the same way. The regional committees select a restaurant that is an institution in the neighborhood or community that it's located in, and it has to have been open, I think, for more than 20 years, and some of them have been 100 years, and we do these great videos. So if you go to jamesbeard.org, you'll see the videos there. And this year, the categories, I mean, how they find these places, you just want to go to every single one. The Fry Bread House in Phoenix,
yes.
Nora's Fish Creek Inn, which is in Wilson, Wyoming, St. Elmo Steakhouse in Indianapolis, which actually is an interesting thing because in Indianapolis this year, in October, a play about James Beard's life, a one-man show called James Beard, I Love to Eat, which was the name of that first cooking show in 1946.
Right. Okay.
It was staged at the Indianapolis Repertory Theater, a really great play written by James Still, and actually at the Beard Awards we're going to debut a little piece of that. It was a great one-man show.
Musical
about
number?
Beard. What?
Is there a musical number?
There is no music, no. Although Beard did come to be a singer on Broadway, hard to believe.
Really?
Yeah, actor, singer, opera, something. Yeah.
Triple threat, if you will.
Yeah, and ended up in food, like many of the waiters we encounter in our day-to-day lives. Anyway, Jones Barbecue Diner is in Marianna, Arkansas, and then Shady Glen in Manchester, Connecticut. The America's Classics are really kind of what it's all about. You know, I guess Guy Fieri now has, on the Food Network, has his own lockup on the diners, drive-ins, and dives thing. But these American Classics are really, I mean, like his places, they're about the fabric of the communities they're in. Some of them historically have been, you know, were owned by Japanese who had been, the family had been interned, and they were given over to friends while they were, during the Second World War. All the stories are amazing. It's a tearjerker moment every year at the ceremony.
I love it. Nothing like celebrating people who've poured their lives into a dedicated place and just banged out excellent food year after year. Looks like you guys have done.
Thanks.
So on that note, we'll wrap it up. What's the website? What's the Twitter feed?
JamesBeard.org, and follow us at Beard Foundation.
That's awesome. It. And I would recommend for anybody, especially the younger people, to really learn about your history of food in not just New York, but America and the world. James Beard is a good place to start.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to it. I will have to make sure that I come dressed correctly to the awards. And,
well, correctly or standing out. You know, red carpet's all about standing out. It's not exactly about correct.
No, it's not. What's that guy? Farmer Al or that?
Yeah, right. Or the guys with the pigs. Last year we had some pigs on the run. They were a hit. Yeah.
Those pigs were awesome. Nothing like doling out whiskey right in front of two pigs. The line just sort of got longer and longer.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Mitchell. Congratulations on everything. Can't wait to have you back again in a year, hopefully, if you'll grace us with your presence.
Of course.
All right, so coming up next, we have a song that's going to transition us into the music. John Norris, part of the show. He picked this song, one of my favorites. It's Taxman by the Beatles here on Snacky Tunes.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Should 5% appear too small? Thankful I don't take it all. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. If you drive a car, I'll tax the street. If you try to sit,
I'll tax your seat.
If you get too cold,
I'll tax the heat.
If you take a walk,
I'll tax your food.
Taxman.
All right, welcome back to Snacky Tunes. The obligatory cram food in our face during the music break was, it's always a pleasure.
It's always so delicious.
It's delicious. So, John Norris, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thanks, man. It's good to be here.
If get ready to hear your the drop that you recorded earlier in the show all over this network. It's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. It was art.
It was more than art. So for those who don't know, John, you are a managing editor and partner in the rock-oriented music website Noisevox. You host interviews at FaceTime. You were a face of, and still are a face of, MTV News.
Not unless someone dies. Usually is when they call me back these days. But not so much anymore. Now, I left at the beginning of 2009, and I've been doing outside writing as well as Noisevox and a number of things. So.
How does it feel to be what is considered one of the seminal voices of music and music culture for the last 20 years?
It feels, on the one hand, good. And, I mean, I can't tell you how many bands and people that I meet who say the words. It's almost like a script. I grew up watching you.
I said it.
Watching you. Five words. And it feels great. And also, like, very, I'm just a sort of live in the moment kind of person. And so while that's super nice, if people ask me one more time about what was it like to report that Kurt had died,
right?
And I mean, it's fine, but I'm you're really, I try to be focused on what's going on now.
You're your own man.
Yeah,
you're your own man. I mean, how can you rough estimate how many singer songwriter bands people you met over the years?
I mean, dude, with Noisevox alone, I've done, we're closing in on, I think, 200 interviews for FaceTime. So, I mean,
are not short interviews either.
No, they're not.
We shoot about 40 minutes and then we post 20, which everybody tells me is sheer lunacy because nobody today has patience for more than 2 minutes of conversation.
You are correct.
So I'm just going, damn the torpedoes. I think that if we do a 20-minute interview with Spiritualized, someone out there, those Spiritualized fans, are going to want to hear what he has to say for 20 minutes.
Yeah. So now that you have Noisevox and you're a partner in it, does that free you from some restraint like that you've had in the past?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously, as over time, while I was at MTV, the channel, it's no secret, moved further and further away from music being their sort of raison d'etre, and then the music that we were covering in the last 5 or 6 years was not really, stuff that I was super into. But it's cool. What they did works for them. And my last year there, they kind of, I think maybe to shut me up, they threw me my own series on Rhapsody because they had a partnership with Rhapsody. And it was basically all bands I loved. And that kind of, honestly, that kind of springboarded me into these kind of interviews that I do now with FaceTime on Noisevox.
And was that more web-based or was that on air on MTV?
Some of it would air, segments of it would be on air, but no, for the most part, it was all web. And we'd have an accompanying article, written piece that I would do that would go on the MTV site, MTV News site. But then the majority, the full, again, they were like, not only were they interviews, but that we did do sessions, like we did Titus Andronicus and there's practice space in Jersey and a bunch of stuff. And that was, I guess it was about 40 minutes. Each episode would be about 40 minutes total, something like that. Yeah.
That's great.
It's fun.
You know, it seems like you have this and you're able to do and a lot more that you wouldn't normally do in terms of coverage. Sure. And going in, do you think that MTV News would have covered like Fiona Apple's new record at this point?
At this point, Fiona's big enough that for all I know, they may be planning some sort of coverage. She is still a major label artist.
She's right. Huge.
Despite the fact that she has this new indie embrace, which I think is terrific, but it's really interesting to see the way that everybody that, you know, because 7 years ago is when she last put out a record, right? So I think, it's no secret that for lack of a better term, the indie rock world is so much more pervasive than it was in 2005. And the fact that they've really sort of, embraced their kind of being one of their own, I think is a cool thing, and it makes sense. I mean, this record that she's got coming out in June is way her most DIY thing yet. It's basically her and her drummer, Charlie, doing a lot of found sound percussion and piano and her. Record. I like it a lot.
I would say I still consider her in the indie vibe and spirit, which is crazy because she's total mainstream.
Yeah.
But she still exists. I think her whole aesthetic has been like a bucker of trends and things like that. She's totally doing her own thing.
Yeah. I guess the most, probably beyond her epitaph would be that DMA speech in 97 where she said this world is bullshit. Where I was like, backstage giving a little thumbs up, even though I was, sitting there taking my check from the man the whole time. But I get where she was coming from. I like Taxman, by the way, especially considering they're voting the Buffett rule today.
They are. You know, I didn't even think about that. Yeah. I keep forgetting it's tax day. Why don't we play a quick song of you have a Fiona Apple song?
I have actually a couple, but let's do, I really like her cover of Across the Universe.
I love that song.
It's a beautiful song.
That was a journey. Remember Pleasure Boy?
Yeah, and this song actually, as I should have had my phone, she convinced John Bryan to work with her on her second album by having him produce this track for Pleasantville. And she was telling me that she, just wanted him to know that she wasn't the crazy 18-year-old that sort of was unstable at the kind of reputation that she got a little bit when things first started. So that's how John doing this song kind of came about.
I think that song just goes on like that for a little bit longer,
yes,
right?
Indeed, yeah. Jay Guru Deva.
Yeah, it's man, double hit of Beatles today. Not intentional. As to looking forward, who are the current bands that you are excited about?
Who am I excited about? I love, as I'm sure you guys know them, but maybe people listening don't, Brooklyn band called Dive, which is a, well, I guess you would have said a few months ago, a side project of Cole Smith, who plays drums in Beach Fossils. And they just got a cool, swirly, chimey kind of pop sound. And I'm really excited about their new album. It's out in June. They've got a single that just came out, I think, about two weeks ago. So I'm excited. I'm talking to them in a few weeks. Who else? I don't know. I love the new Lower Dens album, which is out soon.
Do you still get, like, what? How previewed are you to music? Like, how soon, how early are you still getting albums before everyone else gets to hear them?
It varies. It's funny, that Spiritualized record I heard as long ago as January, but then Jason Pierce famously, you know, micromanaging, never can sort of let it go, had to go back and work on the record again after that. Even
didn't he remix it?
Yeah, exactly. At least part of it. Right. I don't know if the whole thing, but so yeah, the tweaking's finally done. It's out this week, and I'm happy that it's doing well. I got Best New Music Today, so I'm really stoked, because that's a really amazing album.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be top of the charts, number one.
Mercury Prize front runner, I would say, already.
Yeah.
So this weekend is Coachella.
Yes.
And I think some of the, like, it's always funny now with festivals where they feel that it used to just be all new acts. And then when the Pixies sort of kicked off their reunion at Coachella, what is what now, 6 years ago, 7 years ago? Now I feel that no festival is complete without new acts and reunion acts. And
Even Tupac made a comeback.
Yeah.
Virtually.
I didn't see that. Is it as weird as it sounds?
It's pretty strange. I couldn't really make out if it was an actor.
I think it's a hologram.
Yeah, an actor turned into a hologram of Tupac or not.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea.
You know, I saw a release recently about the upcoming Dirty Projectors album, which I'm really excited about.
And yes.
There was a line in there that I thought was really true. We are now a world just steeped in two things, retromania and neophilia. So we want the new, whatever's new, but we also, we can't sort of break away from our love of that, which particularly 90s. I mean, look at, you know, as you're saying, this the nostalgia of Snoop and Dre on stage joined by Tupac. I mean, that's what big festivals have come to. The headliners have to harken back to, you know.
Well, because I don't think in any real new band, there is no incubation period. There isn't like a new band that can pull out 50,000-60,000 people. You need to have a Snoop Dogg or a like Bruce Springsteen or a Radiohead that's been around for a while, but to give it that hip factor, you have to have The Weeknd or, you know, something like that. But even, you know, even their other comebacks, you know, Refused at the Drive-In, things like that, like those are all pulling on people who've been fans for 10, 15 years.
And, you know, and I'm as guilty of, I was certainly sucked into My Bloody Valentine being back a few years ago, or Pavement being back last year. I mean, I don't know. Someone said one time that, you know, every minute spent listening to a record from 15 years ago is a minute not spent listening to new music. And part of me really sort of believe that, you know.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're just like added pressure to be like, I thought, you know, I had already seen them, I'd given my life to them, I'd given my time, I'd moved on to new music. And they get back together, and you're like, well, am I still in that same place where I love them? You know, is it still 10 years ago? And it's like, it's not. But you feel that you have to go see them at some level to, you know, to support them in some weird, that, you know, they supported you musically and through your tough time when you were younger.
True. Yeah. I mean,
and especially if you'd never seen them live, then that's the other.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm going to go see Refused in a couple of weeks.
Right.
And that's going to be, it'll be what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen a lot of, and I'm sure you have reunion shows. Like the only one that was really good, that was like the one that I missed, was Sunday Day Real Estate. Everything else has sort of been, I felt like a cash grab.
Right. Well, I mean, wasn't Malkmus kind of open about that last year? I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah. It is what it is, but, you know, I feel like, you know, I like to live in the moment as much as possible. And that moment could be a new record by a veteran band, too.
You know, absolutely. You know? I think that's my biggest problem with it, is that none of them are putting out, if it's, and I hate to bring it back to Fiona Apple, but she's back, and she's like, and with the promise of being back and putting out a new album. So many of these bands are just like, well, we're just going to play what we already have. We're not going to write new tracks. And it just seems sort of, you're not really continuing the band. You're just getting back together to get a check.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people that aren't, maybe Spiritualized. When was their last record?
For Songs in A&E, which was 4 years ago, 5 years ago, okay. I think, something like that. Yeah.
It's a fair amount of time.
Yeah, fair amount of time. And plus, he takes forever to work on things, too. So, I mean, it was a better part of, I think, 3 years working on this new one.
Right.
So. Not to shift gears completely, but I read somewhere that you are active with PETA.
I am, yes.
How did you get involved with that? Have you always been a vegetarian?
I have not always been a vegetarian. It was one of those gradual things. I was a person who... 20 years ago, I was eating beef and pork, and that went away around then, about 18 years ago. Then it was chicken, and then last piece of sushi I had, I think, was in, I'm pretty sure it was early 05, so it's been a while that I've been strict vegetarian, and then I try to be as vegan as possible as I eat a mozzarella-laced pizza, but... it's just it's an animal thing for me, so it's, but I don't... You know, believe me, most of my friends do not are not on board with that. So.
Not on board?
No.
And when you say mostly really. An animal thing, is it the treatment or the idea of just eating another living creature?
It's the latter. I mean, the idea, and I understand, I get that there are absolutely more responsible and humane ways to go about it. But at the end of the day, for me, it is what it is, you know? There's, you know, lethal injection is more humane than the electric chair, too. But
right.
But the end result is the same. So that's me. But,
yeah, you know, that's you.
But I'm not.
I think the that's me is the most respectful thing you say, whether you're a carnivore, vegetarian, or vegan. Right. It's like, that's just me.
Yeah. But I mean, some people really they don't like it. I mean, and also, you know, the trendiness of vegetarianism that seemed to be around. Whatever, 8-10 years ago, I've only seen vegetarian restaurants in New York close in the last 5 years. I don't think I've seen a new one open. I can't think of a new one.
Dirt Candy,
yeah, that's an amazing place. Actually, right.
But Dirt Candy goes beyond. That's just they go beyond what is just vegetarian food. You know,
yeah.
They're high end dining.
Yeah, no, it is. It's amazing. I used to live right by there, so.
She does great work.
Yeah.
She does great work.
It's amazing. I like the steps. I like the fact that it's just steps from Momofuku, the original Momofuku, too. Right.
It's a real. But that's what makes New York great. Yeah. That yin and yang of just the most meaty, carnivorous temple to food versus the, you know, a temple to shrine of vegetables and things
that. Is it true? I mean, I'm not a foodie, so correct me if I'm wrong. But didn't David Chang originally have some vegetarian things on the menu, and then he got annoyed that people would come in and ask for things without pork, and then he like took them off? Is that true? Is that
not- I don't know. I mean, I think there's always, I don't know if there's always, I think there's always at least one or two vegetarian, you know, when you get to a certain level with chef,
yeah,
things like that, you just start looking at different ingredients as how to highlight them. And if you want to highlight mushrooms and Brussels sprouts and things like that, then more power to you. I think it's the people who like to root around in categories who are just like, oh, I eat meat, so everything's got to have steak, or I eat chicken or something like that, or bacon. Travis, bacon and scallops.
Every morning.
Yeah. So what are you looking forward to? What are you getting into for the rest of the year? And, you know, as we get into the dog days of summer, if you will.
Well, I mentioned that Dirty Projectors record, which I think is out in July. I think that's all indications. I've only heard the single, but it sounds really interesting that they did not. I mean, Dave is not one to repeat himself anyway, but it sounds like they did something quite different. It sounds like it. If that single's any indication, maybe like their warmest kind of sounding record yet. What else? I'm drawing a blank.
Well, what about you? What are you up to?
Well, we've got the 3 series on Noisevox. Yeah. I'm doing writing for several magazines. Under the Radar is probably the one that keeps me the busiest. Also, Interview and Envy Magazine, the fashion magazine, which does a fair amount of music coverage. I did an Ariel Pink piece for them in January, which was great. He's one of my favorites. So I'm keeping busy with all that. I got a couple shows, one in particular in development that I can't really talk about because we'll see where that goes. But yeah,
TV show.
Keeping busy. Yeah, that's the idea. No, it is a TV show, but that's Yeah.
It's awesome. And where do you...
And seriously music-oriented, which, you know, I think what I said, in the way I said earlier, that they say 20-minute interviews are just not, you know, what they're like, what are you thinking in this day and age? But music programming in general, I mean, if you go to a lot of outlets, TV outlets, they'll say it's just, I mean, it just doesn't rate anymore.
It doesn't. No. It's really tough. I mean, a lot of those shows, even the format of just randomness. I mean, remember Current TV, Al Gore's network?
Sure.
Originally, they had the same idea where they were doing like video newscasts and things like that. And just people couldn't, there was no, not that 8:30 a Thursday means anything anymore, but people couldn't really latch on to just an idea of just like, it's going to be totally random in programming. Mm. And they've done that format before. And, but you know, I mean, who still, I guess Fuse still does music.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. Well, yeah. And what's that concert station that's on cable?
I know what you mean.
Palladium.
Yeah.
And they do live concerts, and I guess they do well-ish enough to be on the air.
It's big bands, you know. It's not. I don't know. It's weird. It's weird to me that everything is so narrowcast, and you know, I feel like there is clearly an audience who's into music and into food and into books and into politics, and NPR gets that, but not many other outlets get it. You know. Everything else is, you know, and I'm a big, serious, well, primarily XMU listener, but I also listen to the political channels on Sirius, and, you know, it's all you do, you know, you specialize in one thing. That's the thing, and people want to, like, cast you as this or that, you know, this guy or that guy. And
well, it's either you subscribe to that lifestyle onto that channel, if you will, or you don't.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where it's getting, which is... not bad, I mean, but, you know, it's like, for someone, I mean, you know, listen to KXCP, you know, just like, I just know that out of the 10 songs that they're going to play, I'm probably going to have a general like for 8 of them.
Yeah,
and that's sort of what people want these days, you know, and they want that. And also, they just want to be able to pick and choose themselves.
That's how I feel about XMU, you know, and you know, the mandate there, though, is talk very, very little, you know, it's like music, the idea of being music, people don't want to hear talk, I guess, whatever. talking about music. Yeah, that's the thing. You know, yeah. I don't know.
I think a very specific type of person loves just to talk about music.
Yeah. I mean, people talk about film a lot, and no one seems to. And that's the thing. There's a lot of double standards between music and film, it seems to me. You know, speaking from my own experience, and not to bitch too much, but you know, there's an idea that if you're a film writer, no one says to a film writer who's, let's say, 40, for instance, what are you doing writing about films being made by 25-year-old directors? No one says that. But there is an attitude in music, there is, whether it's spoken or not, that if you've reached a certain age, what are you doing following 22-year-old bands? You know?
Right.
It's this quaint notion, quaint to me anyway, that music is generational, and this is our music, you know? Well, right. Dive, dude, is as much my music as it is a 22-year-old music fan's music.
So. Yeah, I think people just want to own it, and they're like, who are you? It's that thing. It's the new versus the... It's like fine.
It's then, move aside, dad.
Then it's like, you know, then you can't listen to any band that came out more than 2 years ago.
Yeah, apparently not.
Apparently not. It's like you get the access to all the back catalog, and I'm stuck with like this 2010 Line in the Sand or something like that.
But do you think that's more so with... you know, with the web and everything now, like your pitchforks, where you've kind of assumed the positions of your maximum rock and rolls and zines of the day?
Yes, but I think that for anyone to think that the only people reading Stereogum and Pitchfork are 22
totally.
is wrong.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know. So, and nor are the people writing for them necessarily only, you know, 25. So, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's even like, previously, you had your Nick Kents and your Lester Bangs, who were significantly older than most of these bands.
Well, now that
how long was John Peel on the radio talking about new music?
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Till the day he died.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, John, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks, man. It's been fun.
Thank you.
We've talked about a ton of bands. We have time for one more song. Which of these? What would you like to hear? We got every band that you've mentioned has a song on your playlist.
Well, I don't know. I mean, Yuck was my number one album of last year, and their new song sounds a lot like Smashing Pumpkins, which is not a bad thing.
No, let's not do it at all.
And
should we do it?
Chew? Yeah, let's do that.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Travis. Always a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you.
John, good thank you. Man.
Thanks a lot.
Mitchell Davis, you're the best. Thank you to everybody. Thank you to Roberta's for the lovely pizza. To all of our wonderful sponsors here on Heritage Radio Network. We have Chew by
Yuck.
We're
going to chew on some pizza.
Yes, chewing on some pizza. The puns.
Chew.
Puns of the end. We'll catch you next week. See you later.
Listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.